captain of Storks to observe the 13 remaining soldiers.
Where is she?
In contrast to when they had first arrived, the soldiers appeared sullen and haggard, their weapons nicked and their armour dented. Most of them wore bandages that were rusty with splotches of dried blood. The men were clumped together, facing the two Razak, both of whom were now hooded, across a low fire. One man was shouting,
"Over half of us killed by a bunch of inbred, cockle-brained woodrats that can't tell a pike from a poleaxe or find the point of a sword even if it's lodged in their gut, because you don't have half the sense my banner boy does. I don't care if Galbatorix himself licks your boots clean. We won't do a thing until we have a new commander."
The men nodded.
"One who's human."
"Really?" demanded the Razak softly.
"We've had enough taking orders from hunchbacks like you with all your clicking and teapot whistling makes us sick. And I don't know what you did with Sardson, but if you stay another night, we'll put steel in you and find out if you bleed like us. You can leave the girl, though. She'll be..."
The man did not get a chance to continue, for the largest Razak jumped across the fire and landed on his shoulders like a giant crow. Screaming, the soldier collapsed under the weight. He tried to draw his sword, but the Razak pecked twice at his neck with its hidden beak, and he was still.
"We have to fight that?"
muttered Ivor behind Roran. The soldiers remained frozen with shock as the two Razak lapped from the neck of the corpse. When the black creatures rose, they rubbed their knobby hands together as if they were washing and said,
"Yes, we will go. Stay if you wish. Reinforcements are only days away."
The Razak threw back their heads and began to shriek at the sky, the wail becoming increasingly shrill until it passed from hearing. Roran looked up as well. At first he saw nothing, but then a nameless terror gripped him as two barbed shadows appeared high over the spine, eclipsing the stars. They advanced quickly, growing larger and larger until they obscured half the sky with their ominous presence. A foul wind rushed across the land, bringing with it a sulphurous miasma that made Roran cough and gag. The soldiers were likewise afflicted, their curses echoed as they pressed sleeves and scarves over their noses. Above them, the shadows paused and then began to drift downward, enclosing the camp in a dome of menacing darkness. The sickly torches flickered and threatened to extinguish themselves, yet they still provided sufficient light to reveal the two beasts descending among the tents. Their bodies were naked and hairless, like newborn mice, with leathery grey skin pulled tight across their corded chests and bellies. In form, they resembled starved dogs, except that their hind legs bulged with enough muscle to crush a boulder. A narrow crest extended from the back of each of their attenuated heads, opposite a long, straight, ebony beak made for spearing prey and cold, bulbous eyes identical to the Razak's. From their shoulders and backs sprang huge wings that made the air moan under their weight. Flinging themselves to the ground, the soldiers cowered and hid their faces from the monsters. A terrible alien intelligence emanated from the creatures, bespeaking a race far older and far more powerful than humans. Roran was suddenly afraid that his mission might fail. Behind him, Horst whispered to the men, urging them to hold their ground and remain hidden, else they would be slain. The Razak bowed to the beasts, then slipped into a tent and returned, carrying Katrina, who was bound with ropes, and leading Sloane. The butcher walked freely. Roran stared, unable to comprehend how Sloane had been captured. "His house isn't anywhere near Horst's." Then it struck him.
"He betrayed us," said Roran with wonder.
His fist slowly tightened on his hammer as the true horror of the situation exploded within him.
"He killed Bird and he betrayed us."
Tears of rage streamed down his face.
"Roran," murmured Horst, crouching beside him, "we can't attack now. They'd slaughter us. Roran, do you hear me?"
He heard but a whisper in the distance as he watched the smaller Razak jump onto one beast above the shoulders, then catch Katrina as the other Razak tossed her up. Sloane seemed upset and frightened now. He began arguing with the Razak, shaking his head and pointing at the ground. Finally, the Razak struck him across the mouth, knocking him unconscious. Mounting the second beast, with the butcher slung over its shoulder, the largest Razak declared,
"We will return once it is safe again. Kill the boy, and your lives are forfeit."
Then the steeds flexed their massive thighs and leaped into the sky, once again shadows upon the field of stars. No words or emotions were left to Roran. He was utterly destroyed. All that remained was to kill the soldiers. He stood and raised his hammer in preparation to charge, but as he stepped forward, his head throbbed in unison with his wounded shoulder, the ground vanished in a burst of light, and he toppled into oblivion.
Arrow to the Heart. Every day since leaving the outpost of Ceres was a hazy dream of warm afternoons spent paddling up Eldor Lake and then the Gaina River. All around them water gurgled through the tunnel of verdant pines that wound ever deeper into Dueldenvaren. Eragon found travelling with the elves delightful. Nari and Lyfane were perpetually smiling, laughing and singing songs, especially when Saphira was around. They rarely looked elsewhere or spoke of another subject but her in her presence. However, the elves were not human, no matter the similarity of appearance. They moved too quickly, too fluidly, for creatures born of simple flesh and blood. And when they spoke, they often used roundabout expressions and aphorisms that left Eragon more confused than when they began. In between their bursts of merriment, Lyfane and Nari would remain silent for hours, observing their surroundings with a glow of peaceful rapture on their faces. If Eragon or Oryk attempted to talk with them during their contemplation, they would receive only a word or two in response. It made Eragon appreciate how direct and forthright Arya was by comparison. In fact, she seemed uneasy around Lyfane and Nari, as if she were no longer sure how to behave with her own kind. From the prow of the canoe, Lyfane looked over his shoulder and said, "Tell me, Eragon, Finiarel, what do your people sing about in these dark days? I remember the epics and lays I heard in Illyria, sagas of your proud kings and earls, but it was long, long ago, and the memories are like withered flowers in my mind. What new works have your people created?" Eragon frowned as he tried to recall the names of stories Brom had recited. When Lyfane heard them, he shook his head sorrowfully and said, "So much has been lost. No court ballads survive, and if you speak truly, nor does most of your history or art, except for fanciful tales Galbatorix has allowed to thrive."
"Brom once told us about the fall of the riders," said Eragon defensively.
An image of a deer bounding over rotting logs flashed behind his eyes from Saphira, who was off hunting.
"Ah, a brave man."
For a minute, Lyfane paddled silently.
"We too sing about the fall, but rarely. Most of us were alive when Vrail entered the void, and we still grieve for our burned cities. The red lilies of Iwaena, the crystals of Luthivira, and for our slain families. Time cannot dull the pain of those wounds. Not if 1,000,000 years pass and the sun itself dies, leaving the world to float in eternal night."
Oryk grunted in the back,
"As it is with the dwarves. Remember, Elf, we lost an entire clan to Galbatorix."
"And we lost our king, Evandar."
"I never heard that," said Eragon, surprised. Lyfane nodded as he guided them around a submerged rock.
"Few have. Brom could have told you about it. He was there when the fatal blow was struck. Before Vrail's death, the elves faced Galbatorix on the plains of Illyria in our final attempt to defeat him. There, Evandar..."
"Where is Illyria?" asked Eragon.
It's Urubane,
boy, said Oric.
Used to be an elf city.
Unperturbed by the interruption, Lefain continued. As you say, Illyria was one of our cities. We abandoned it during our war with the dragons, and then, centuries later, humans adopted it as their capital after King Palancar was exiled. Aragorn said, King Palancar? Who was he? Is that how Palancar Valley got its name? This time the elf turned and looked at him with amusement. You have as many questions as leaves on a tree, Arjit Laum. Brom was of the same opinion. Lefain smiled, then paused as if to gather his thoughts. When your ancestors arrived in Alagasia 800 years ago, they roamed far across it, seeking a suitable place to live. Eventually they settled in Palancar Valley, though it was not called such then, as it was one of the few defendable locations that we or the dwarves had not claimed. There your king, Palancar, began to build a mighty state. In an attempt to expand his borders, he declared war against us, though we had offered no provocation. 3 times he attacked, and 3 times we prevailed. Our strength frightened Palancar's nobles, and they pled with their liege for peace. He ignored their counsel. Then the lords approached us with a treaty, which we signed without the king's knowledge. With our help, Palancar was usurped and banished, but he, his family, and their vassals refused to leave the valley. Since we had no wish to murder them, we constructed the Tower of Ristvakbane, so the riders could watch over Palancar and ensure he would never again rise to power or attack anyone else in Alagasia. Before long, Palancar was killed by a son who did not wish to wait for nature to take its course. Thereafter, family politics consisted of assassination, betrayal, and other depravities, reducing Palancar's house to a shadow of its former grandeur. However, his descendants never left, and the blood of kings still runs in Therensford and Carvajal.
I see, said Aragorn.
Lefain lifted one dark eyebrow. Do you? It has more significance than you may think. It was this event that convinced Anúrin, Freyll's predecessor as head rider, to allow humans to become riders in order to prevent similar disputes. Oric emitted a bark of laughter.
That must have caused some argument.
It was an unpopular decision, admitted Lefain. Even now, some question the wisdom of it. It caused such a disagreement between Anúrin and Queen Delenor that Anúrin seceded from our government and established the Riders on Vroengard as an independent entity.
But if the Riders were separated from your government, then how could they keep the peace as they were supposed to? Asked Aragorn.
They couldn't, said Lefain. Not until Queen Delenor saw the wisdom of having the Riders free of any lord or king and restored their access to Dúeldenvarden. Still, it never pleased her that any authority could supersede her own.
Aragorn frowned. Wasn't that the whole point, though?
Yes, and no. The Riders were supposed to guard against the failings of the different governments and races, yet who watched the Watchers? It was that very problem that caused the fall. No one existed who could descry the flaws within the Riders' own system, for they were above scrutiny, and thus they perished. Aragorn stroked the water, first on one side and then the other, while he considered Lefain's words. His paddle fluttered in his hands as it cut diagonally across the current. Who succeeded Delenor as king or queen?
Evandar did. He took the knotted throne 500 years ago, when Delenor abdicated in order to study the mysteries of magic, and held it until his death. Now his mate, Islanzadi, rules us.
That's... Aragorn stopped with his mouth open. He was going to say impossible, but then realized how ridiculous the statement would sound. Instead, he asked, Are elves immortal?
In a soft voice, Lefain said, Once we were like you, bright, fleeting, and as ephemeral as the morning dew. Now our lives stretch endlessly through the dusty years. Aye, we are immortal, although we are still vulnerable to injuries of the flesh.
You became immortal? How? The elf refused to elaborate, though Aragorn pressed him for details. Finally, Aragorn asked, How old is Arya? Lefain turned his glittering eyes on him, probing Aragorn with disconcerting acuteness. Arya, what is your interest in her? Aragorn faltered, suddenly unsure of his intentions. His attraction to Arya was complicated by the fact that she was an elf, and that her age, whatever it might be, was so much greater than his own. She must view me as a child. I don't know, he said honestly, but she saved both my life and Saphira's, and I'm curious to know more about her. I feel ashamed, said Lefain, pronouncing each word carefully, for asking such a question. Among our kind it is rude to pry into one's affairs, only I must say, and I believe that Oric agrees with me, that you would do well to guard your heart, Arjitlam. Now is not the time to lose it, nor would it be well placed in this instance.
Aye,
grunted Oric. Heat suffused Aragorn as blood rushed to his face like hot tallow melting through him. Before he could utter a retort, Saphira entered his mind and said,
And now is the time to guard your tongue. They mean well. Don't insult them.
He took a deep breath and tried to let his embarrassment drain away. Do you agree with them?
I believe, Aragorn, that you are full of love and that you are looking for one who will reciprocate your affection. No shame exists in that.
He struggled to digest her words, then finally said, Will you be back soon?
I'm on my way now.
Returning his attention to his surroundings, Aragorn found that both the elf and the dwarf were watching him. I understand your concern, and I'd still like my question answered. Lefain hesitated briefly.
Arya is quite young. She was born a year before the destruction of the Riders.
100? Though he had expected such a figure, Aragorn was still shocked. He concealed it behind a blank face, thinking, She could have great-grandchildren older than me. He brooded on the subject for several minutes and then, to distract himself, said, You mentioned that humans discovered Alagazia 800 years ago, yet Brom said that we arrived 3 centuries after the Riders were formed, which was thousands of years ago.
2,704 years, by our reckoning,
declared Oric.
Brom was right, if you consider a single ship with 20 warriors the arrival of humans in Alagazia. They landed in the south, where Surda is now. We met while they were exploring and exchanged gifts, but then they departed, and we didn't see another human for almost 2 millennia. Or until King Palancar arrived with a fleet in tow. The humans had completely forgotten us by then, except for vague stories about hairy men of the mountains that preyed on children in the night. Bah!
Do you know where Palancar came from? Asked Aragorn. Oric frowned and gnawed the tip of his moustache, then shook his head.
Our histories only say that his homeland was far to the south, beyond the Beors, and that his exodus was the result of war and famine.
Excited by the idea, Aragorn blurted, So there might be countries elsewhere that could help us against Galbatorix.
Possibly, said Oric, but they would be difficult to find, even on Dragonback, and I doubt that you'd speak the same language. Who would want to help us, though? The Varden have little to offer another country, and it's hard enough to get an army from Farthendur to Urabain, much less bring forces from hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away.
We could not spare you anyway, said Lefain to Aragorn.
Aragorn broke off as Saphira soared over the river, followed by a furious crowd of sparrows and blackbirds intent on driving her away from their nests. At the same time, a chorus of squeaks and chatters burst from the armies of squirrels hidden among the branches. Lefain beamed and cried,
Isn't she glorious? See how her scales catch the light!
No treasure in the world can match this sight. Similar exclamations floated across the river from Nari.
Bloody unbearable, that's what it is,
muttered Auric into his beard. Aragorn hid a smile, though he agreed with the dwarf. The elves never seemed to tire of praising Saphira.
Nothing's wrong with a few compliments, said Saphira.
She landed with a gigantic splash and submerged her head to escape a diving sparrow. Of course not, said Aragorn. Saphira eyed him from underwater.
Was that sarcasm?
He chuckled and let it pass. Glancing at the other boat, Aragorn watched Arya paddle, her back perfectly straight, her face inscrutable as she floated through webs of mottled light beneath the mossy trees. She seemed so dark and somber, it made him want to comfort her. Lyfane, he asked softly so that Auric would not hear, why is Arya so unhappy? You and... Lyfane's shoulders stiffened underneath his russet tunic, and he whispered so low that Aragorn could barely hear.
We are honoured to serve Arya Drotningu. She has suffered more than you can imagine for our people. We celebrate out of joy for what she has achieved with Saphira, and weep in our dreams for her sacrifice and her loss. Her sorrows are her own, though, and I cannot reveal them without her permission.
As Aragorn sat by their nightly campfire, petting a swatch of moss that felt like rabbit fur, he heard a commotion deeper in the forest. Exchanging glances with Saphira and Auric, he crept toward the sound, drawing Zarok. Aragorn stopped at the lip of a small ravine and looked across to the other side, where a gerfalcon with a broken wing thrashed in a bed of snowberries. The raptor froze when it saw him, then opened its beak and uttered a piercing screech.
"What a terrible fate, to be unable to fly!" said Saphira.
When Arya arrived, she eyed the gerfalcon, then strung her bow, and with unerring aim shot it through the breast. At first Aragorn thought that she had done it for food, but she made no move to retrieve either the bird or her arrow. "Why?" he asked. With a hard expression, Arya unstrung her bow. "It was too injured for me to heal, and would have died tonight or tomorrow. Such is the nature of things. I saved it hours of suffering." Saphira lowered her head and touched Arya on the shoulder with her snout, then returned to their camp, her tail scraping bark off the trees. As Aragorn started to follow, he felt Auric tuck his sleeve and bent down to hear the dwarf say in an undertone,
"Never ask an elf for help. They might decide that you're better off dead, eh?"
The Dagshelgar Invocation. Though he was tired from the previous day, Aragorn forced himself to rise before dawn in an attempt to catch one of the elves asleep. It had become a game with him to discover when the elves got up, or if they slept at all, as he had yet to see any of them with their eyes closed. Today was no exception. "Good morning," said Nari and Lyfane from above him. Aragorn craned back his head and saw that they each stood on the bough of a pine tree, over 50 feet in the air. Jumping from branch to branch with feline grace, the elves dropped to the ground alongside him.
"We have been keeping watch," explained Lyfane.
"For what?" Arya stepped around a tree and said,
"For my fears. Duweldenvarden has many mysteries and dangers, especially for a rider. We have lived here for thousands of years, and old spells still linger in unexpected places. Magic permeates the air, the water, and the earth. In places, it has affected the animals. Sometimes strange creatures are found roaming the forest, and not all of them friendly."
"Are they..." Aragorn stopped, as his Gedwe Ignazia tingled. The silver hammer on the necklace Ganel had given him grew hot on his chest, and he felt the amulet's spell draw upon his strength. Someone was trying to scry him. "Is it Galbatorix?" he wondered, frightened. He clutched the necklace and pulled it out of his tunic, ready to yank it off should he become too weak. From the other side of the camp, Saphira rushed to his side, bolstering him with her own reserves of energy. A moment later, the heat leached out of the hammer, leaving it cold against Aragorn's skin. He bounced it on his palm, then tucked it back under his clothes, whereupon Saphira said,
"Our enemies are searching for us."
Enemies? Could not it be someone in Duvrangor Gata?
I think Hrothgar would have told Naswada that he ordered Ganel to enchant you this necklace. She might have even come up with the idea in the first place.
Arya frowned when Aragorn explained what had occurred.
This makes it all the more important we reach Ellesmere quickly, so your training can resume. Events in Alagazia move apace, and I fear you won't have adequate time for your studies.
Aragorn wanted to discuss it further, but lost the opportunity in the rush to leave camp. Once the canoes were loaded and the fire tamped out, they continued to forge up the Gaina River. They had only been on the water for an hour when Aragorn noticed that the river was growing wider and deeper. A few minutes later, they came upon a waterfall that filled Duweldenvarden with its throbbing rumble. The cataract was about 100 feet tall and streamed down a stone face with an overhang that made it impossible to climb.
How do we get past that?
He could already feel cool spray on his face. Lefane pointed at the left shore, some distance from the falls, where a trail had been worn up the steep ridge. We have to portage our canoes and supplies for 1/2 a league before the river clears. The 5 of them untied the bundles wedged between the seats of the canoes and divided the supplies into piles that they stuffed into their packs.
Ugh,
said Aragorn, hefting his load. It was twice as heavy as what he usually carried when travelling on foot.
I could fly it upstream for you, all of it,
offered Saphira, crawling onto the muddy bank and shaking herself dry. When Aragorn repeated her suggestion, Lefane looked horrified.
We would never dream of using a dragon as a beast of burden. It would dishonour you, Saphira, and Aragorn as Surtagal, and it would shame our hospitality.
Saphira snorted, and a plume of flame erupted from her nostrils, vaporising the surface of the river and creating a cloud of steam.
This is nonsense!
Reaching past Aragorn with one scaly leg, she hooked her talons through the pack's shoulder straps, then took off over their heads.
Catch me if you can!
A peal of clear laughter broke the silence, like the trill of a mockingbird. Amazed, Aragorn turned and looked at Arya. It was the first time he had ever heard her laugh. He loved the sound. She smiled at Lefane.
You have much to learn if you presume to tell a dragon what she may or may not do.
But the dishonour...
It is no dishonour if Saphira does it of her free will, asserted Arya. Now let us go before we waste any more time.
Hoping that the strain would not trigger the pain in his back, Aragorn picked up his canoe with Lefane and fitted over his shoulders. He was forced to rely on the elf to guide him along the trail, as he could only see the ground beneath his feet. An hour later they had topped the ridge and hiked beyond the dangerous white water to where the Gaina River was once again calm and glassy. Waiting for them was Saphira, who was busy catching fish in the shallows, jabbing her triangular head into the water like a heron. Arya called her over and said to both her and Aragorn,
Beyond the next curve lies Ardwen Lake, and upon its western shore, Seelthrim, one of our greatest cities. Past that, a vast expanse of forest still separates us from Ellesmere. We will encounter many elves close to Seelthrim. However, I don't want either of you to be seen until we speak with Queen Islanzadi.
Why?
Asked Saphira, echoing Aragorn's thoughts. In her musical accent, Arya answered,
Your presence requires a great and terrible change for our kingdom, and such shifts are dangerous unless handled with care. The Queen must be the first to meet with you. Only she has the authority and wisdom to oversee this transition.
You speak highly of her, commented Aragorn. At his words, Nari and Lefane stopped and watched Arya with guarded eyes. Her face went blank. Then she drew herself up proudly.
She has led us well. Aragorn, I know you carry a hooded cape from Trondheim. Until we are free of possible observers, will you wear it and keep your head covered so that none can see your rounded ears and know that you are human?" He nodded. "And Saphira, you must hide during the day and catch up with us at night. Arjihad told me that is what you did in the Empire."
"And I hated every moment of it,"
she growled.
"It's only for today and tomorrow. After that, we will be far enough away from Sealthrim that we won't have to worry about encountering anyone of consequence," promised Arya.
Saphira turned her azure eyes on Aragorn.
"When we escaped the Empire, I swore that I would always stay close enough to protect you. Every time I leave, bad things happen. Yazuak, Darrett, Drasleona, the slavers."
"Not in Tirm."
"You know what I mean. I'm especially loath to leave, since you can't defend yourself with your crippled back."
"I trust that Arya and the others will keep me safe, don't you?"
Saphira hesitated.
"I trust Arya."
She twisted away and padded up the riverbank, sat for a minute, then returned.
"Very well."
She broadcast her acceptance to Arya, adding,
"But I won't wait any longer than tomorrow night, even if you're in the middle of Sealthrim at the time."
"I understand," said Arya. "You will still have to be careful when flying after dark, as elves can see clearly on all but the blackest nights. If you are sighted by chance, you could be attacked by magic."
"Wonderful,"
commented Saphira. While Oric and the elves repacked the boats, Aragorn and Saphira explored the dim forest, searching for a suitable hiding place. They settled on a dry hollow rimmed by crumbling rocks and blanketed with a bed of pine needles that were pleasantly soft underfoot. Saphira curled up on the ground and nodded her head.
"Go now. I will be fine."
Aragorn hugged her neck, careful to avoid her sharp spines, and then reluctantly departed, glancing backward. At the river, he donned his cape before they resumed their journey. The air was motionless when Arduin Lake came into view, and as a result, the vast mantle of water was smooth and flat, a perfect mirror for the trees and clouds. The illusion was so flawless, Aragorn felt as if he were looking through a window at another world, and that if they continued forward, the canoes would fall endlessly into the reflected sky. He shivered at the thought. In the hazy distance, numerous white birch-bark boats darted like water striders along both shores, propelled to incredible speeds by the elves' strength. Aragorn ducked his head and tugged on the edge of his hood to ensure that it covered his face. His link with Saphira grew ever more tenuous the farther apart they became, until only a wisp of thought connected them. By evening, he could no longer feel her presence, even if he strained his mind to its limits. All of a sudden, Duweldenvarden seemed much more lonely and desolate. As the gloom deepened, a cluster of white lights, placed at every conceivable height among the trees, sprang into existence a mile ahead. The sparks glowed with the silver radiance of the full moon, eerie and mysterious in the night.
"There lies Sealthrim," said Lefain.
With a faint splash, a dark boat passed them from the opposite direction, accompanied by a murmur of "Kvet Afrike" from the elf steering. Arya brought her canoe alongside Aragorn's.
"We will stop here tonight."
They made a camp a ways from Arduin Lake, where the ground was dry enough to sleep on. The ferocious droves of mosquitoes forced Arya to cast a protective spell so that they could eat dinner in relative comfort. Afterward, the five of them sat around the fire, staring at the gold flames. Aragorn leaned his head against a tree and watched a meteor streak across the sky. His eyelids were about to sink shut when a woman's voice drifted through the woods from Sealthrim, a faint susurration that brushed the inside of his ear like a down feather. He frowned and straightened, trying to better hear the tenuous whisper. Like a thread of smoke that thickens as a newborn fire blazes to life, so the voice rose in strength, until the forest sighed with a teasing, twisting melody that leaped and fell with wild abandon. More voices joined the unearthly song, embroidering the original theme with 100 variations. The air itself seemed to shimmer with the fabric of the tempestuous music. The fey strains sent jolts of elation and fear down Aragorn's spine. They clouded his senses, drawing him into the velvet night.
Seduced by the haunting notes, he jumped to his feet, ready to dash through the forest until he found the source of the voices, ready to dance among the trees and moss, anything, so that he could join the elves' revels. But before he could move, Arya caught his arm and yanked him around to face her.
"Aragorn, clear your mind."
He struggled in a futile attempt to break her grip.
"Heidr Araya Onar, empty your ears."
Everything fell silent then, as if he had gone deaf. He stopped fighting and looked around, wondering what had just occurred. On the other side of the fire, Lefain and Nari wrestled noiselessly with Oryk. Aragorn watched Arya's mouth move as she spoke, then sound returned to the world with a pop, though he could no longer hear the music.
"What?" he asked, dazed.
"Get off me,"
growled Oryk. Lefain and Nari lifted their hands and backed away.
"Your pardon, Oryk Fodor," said Lefain.
Arya gazed towards Sealthrum.
"I miscounted the days. I didn't want to be anywhere near a city during Dagshelga. Our Saturnalias, our celebrations, are perilous for mortals. We sing in the ancient language, and the lyrics weave spells of passion and longing that are difficult to resist, even for us."
Nari stirred restlessly. "We should be at a grove."
"We should," agreed Arya, "but we will do our duty and wait."
Shaken, Aragorn sat closer to the fire, wishing for Saphira. He was sure she could have protected his mind from the music's influence.
"What is the point of Dagshelga?" he asked.
Arya joined him on the ground, crossing her long legs.
"It is to keep the forest healthy and fertile. Every spring we sing for the trees, we sing for the plants, and we sing for the animals. Without us, Duweldenvarden would be half its size."
As if to emphasize her point, birds, deer, squirrels, red and grey, striped badgers, foxes, rabbits, wolves, frogs, toads, tortoises, and every other nearby animal forsook their hiding and began to rush madly about with a cacophony of yelps and cries.
"They are searching for mates," explained Arya. "All across Duweldenvarden, in each of our cities, elves are singing this song. The more who participate, the stronger the spell, and the greater Duweldenvarden will be this year."
Aragorn snatched back his hand as a trio of hedgehogs trundled past his thigh. The entire forest yammered with noise.
"I've stepped into fairyland," he thought, hugging himself.
Oryk came around the fire and raised his voice above the clamour.
"By my beard and my axe, I'll not be controlled against my will by magic. If it happens again, Arya, I swear on Helsvog's stone girdle that I'll return to Fardendur, and you will have the wrath of Durgrimstingitum to deal with."
"It was not my intention for you to experience Dagshelga," said Arya. "I apologize for my mistake. However, though I am shielding you from this spell, you cannot escape magic in Duweldenvarden. It permeates everything."
"So long as it doesn't befoul my mind."
Oryk shook his head and fingered the haft of his axe while eyeing the shadowy beasts that lumbered in the gloom beyond the pool of firelight. No one slept that night. Aragorn and Oryk remained awake because of the frightful din and the animals that kept crashing by their tents. The elves, because they still listened to the song. Lefain and Nari took to pacing in endless circles, while Arya stared toward Sealthrim with a hungry expression, her tawny skin drawn thin and taut over her cheekbones. 4 hours into the riot of sound and motion, Saphira dove out of the sky, her eyes sparkling with a queer aspect. She shivered and arched her neck, panting between her open jaws.
"The forest," she said, "is alive, and I am alive. My blood burns like never before. It burns as yours burns when you think of Arya. I understand."
Aragorn put his hand on her shoulder, feeling the tremors that racked her frame. Her sides vibrated as she hummed along with the music. She gripped the ground with her ivory claws, her muscles coiled and clenched in a supreme effort to remain motionless. The tip of her tail twitched like she was about to pounce. Arya stood and joined Aragorn on the opposite side of Saphira. The elf also put a hand on Saphira's shoulder, and the three of them faced the darkness, united into a living chain. When dawn broke, the first thing Aragorn noticed was that all the trees now had buds of bright green needles at the ends of their branches. He bent and examined the snowberries at his feet and found that every plant, large or small, had acquired new growth during the night. The forest vibrated with the ripeness of its colours. Everything was lush and fresh and clean. The air smelled like it had just rained. Zephira shook herself beside Aragorn and said,
"The fever has passed. I am myself again. Such things I felt. It was as if the world were being born anew, and I was helping to create it with the fire in my limbs."
"How are you? On the inside, I mean."
"I will need some time to understand what I experienced."
Since the music had ceased, Arya removed her spell from Aragorn and Oric. She said, "Lefain, Nari, go to Seelthrim and get horses for the five of us. We cannot walk all the way from here to Ellesmira. Also, alert Captain Demetha that Ceres requires reinforcements." Nari bowed.
"And what shall we say when she asks why we have deserted our post?"
"Tell her that that which she once hoped for and feared has occurred. The worm has bitten its own tail. She will understand."
The two elves departed for Seelthrim after the boats were emptied of supplies. 3 hours later, Aragorn heard a stick snap and looked up to see them returning through the forest on proud white stallions, leading 4 other identical horses. The magnificent beasts moved among the trees with uncanny stealth, their coats shimmering in the emerald twilight. None of them wore saddles or harnesses.
"Blother, blother,"
murmured Lefain, and his steed halted, pawing the ground with its dark hooves.
"Are all your horses as noble as these?" asked Aragorn.
He cautiously approached one, amazed by its beauty. The animals were only a few hands taller than ponies, which made it easy for them to navigate among the closely placed trunks. They did not seem frightened by Zephira.
"Not all," laughed Nari, tossing his silver hair, "but most. We have bred them for many centuries."
"How am I supposed to ride?"
Arya said.
"An elf horse responds instantly to commands in the ancient language. Tell it where you wish to go and it will take you. However, do not mistreat them with blows or harsh words, for they are not our slaves, but our friends and partners. They bear you only so long as they consent to. It is a great privilege to ride one. I was only able to save Saphira's egg from Durza because our horses sensed that something was amiss and stopped us from riding into his ambush. They won't let you fall unless you deliberately throw yourself off, and they are skilled in choosing the safest, quickest path through treacherous ground. The dwarves Feldenost are like that."
"Right you are," grunted Oric. "A Feldenost can run you up a cliff and down without a single bruise. But how can we carry food and whatnot without saddles? I won't ride while wearing a full pack."
Lefain tossed a pile of leather bags at Oric's feet and indicated the 6th horse.
"Nor will you have to."
It took half an hour to arrange their supplies in the bags and heap them into a lumpy mound on the horse's back. Afterward, Nari told Aragorn and Oric the words they could use to direct the horses.
"Ganga fram, to go forward. Blother, to stop. Hlaupa, if needs you must run. And Ganga apter, to go back. You can give more precise instructions if you know more of the ancient language."
He led Aragorn to a horse and said,
"This is Folkvir. Hold out your hand."
Aragorn did, and the stallion snorted, flaring its nostrils. Folkvir sniffed Aragorn's palm, then touched it with his muzzle and allowed Aragorn to stroke his thick neck.
"Good," said Nari, appearing satisfied.
The elf had Oric do the same with the next horse. As Aragorn mounted Folkvir, Zephira drew closer. He looked up at her, noting how troubled she still seemed from the night.
"One more day," he said.
"Aragorn,"
she paused.
"I thought of something while I was under the influence of the elves' spell. something that I have always considered of little consequence, but now looms within me like a mountain of black dread. Every creature, no matter how pure or monstrous, has a mate of their own kind. Yet I have none.
She shuddered and closed her eyes.
In this regard, I am alone.
Her statements reminded Aragorn that she was barely more than 8 months old. On most occasions, her youth did not show, due to the influence of her hereditary instincts and memories. But in this arena, she was even more inexperienced than he was, with his feeble stabs at romance in Carval and Trondheim. Pity welled inside Aragorn, but he suppressed it before it could seep across their mental link. Saphira would have only contempt for the emotion. It could neither solve her problem nor make her feel better. Instead, he said, Galbatorix still has 2 dragon eggs. During our first audience with Hrothgar, you mentioned that you would like to rescue them. If we can... Saphira snorted bitterly.
It could take years, and even if we did retrieve the eggs, I have no guarantee that they would hatch, nor that they would be male, nor that we would be fit mates. Fate has abandoned my race to extinction.
She lashed her tail with frustration, breaking a sapling in 2. She seemed perilously close to tears. What can I say? He asked, disturbed by her distress. You can't give up hope. You still have a chance to find a mate, but you have to be patient. Even if Galbatorix's eggs don't work, dragons must exist elsewhere in the world, just like humans, elves and urgles do. The moment we are free of our obligations, I'll help you search for them, all right?
All right,
she sniffed. She craned back her head and released a puff of white smoke that dispersed among the branches overhead.
I should know better than to let my emotions get the best of me.
Nonsense! You would have to be made of stone not to feel this way. It's perfectly normal. But promise you won't dwell on it while you're alone. She fixed 1 giant sapphire eye on him.
I won't.
He turned warm inside as he felt her gratitude for his reassurances and companionship. Leaning out from Folkvir, he put a hand on her rough cheek and held it there for a moment.
Go on, little one, she murmured. I will see you later.
Aragorn hated to leave her in such a state. He reluctantly entered the forest with Oric and the elves, heading west toward the heart of Du Weldenvarden. After an hour spent pondering Saphira's plight, he mentioned it to Arya. Faint lines creased Arya's forehead as she frowned. It is one of Galbatorix's greatest crimes. I do not know if a solution exists, but we can hope. We must hope. The Pinewood City. Aragorn had been in Du Weldenvarden for so long that he had begun to long for clearings, fields, or even a mountain, instead of the endless tree trunks and meagre underbrush. His flights with Saphira provided no respite, as they only revealed hills of prickly green that rolled unbroken into the distance, like a verdant sea. Oftentimes the branches were so thick overhead it was impossible to tell from what direction the sun rose and set. That, combined with the repetitive scenery, made Aragorn hopelessly lost, no matter how many times Arya or Lithaine troubled to show him the points of the compass. If not for the elves, he knew that he could wander in Du Weldenvarden for the rest of his life without ever finding his way free. When it rained, the clouds and the forest canopy plunged them into profound darkness, as if they were entombed deep underground. The falling water would collect on the black pine needles above, then trickle through and pour 100 feet or more down onto their heads, like 1,000 little waterfalls. At such times, Arya would summon a glowing orb of green magic that floated over her right hand and provided the only light in the cavernous forest. They would stop and huddle underneath a tree until the storm abated, but even then water cached in the myriad branches would, at the slightest provocation, shower them with droplets for hours afterward. As they rode deeper into the heart of Du Weldenvarden, the trees grew thicker and taller, as well as farther apart to accommodate the increased span of their branches. The trunks, bare brown shafts that towered up into the overarching ribbed ceiling, which was smudged and obscured by shadow, were over 200 feet tall, higher than any tree in the spine or the Beors. Aragorn paced out the girth of one tree and measured it at 70 feet. He mentioned this to Arya, and she nodded, saying, "It means that we are near Ellesmira." She reached out and rested her hand lightly on the gnarled root beside her, as if touching with consummate delicacy the shoulder of a friend or lover. "These trees are among the oldest living creatures in Alagaesia. Elves have loved them since first we saw Du-Weldenvarden, and we have done everything in our power to help them flourish." A faint blade of light pierced the dusty emerald branches overhead and limned her arm and face with liquid gold, dazzlingly bright against the murky background. "We have travelled far together, Aragorn, but now you are about to enter my world. Tread softly, for the earth and air are heavy with memories, and naught is as it seems. Do not fly with Saphira today, as we have already triggered certain wards that protect Ellesmira. It would be unwise to stray from the path." Aragorn bowed his head and retreated to Saphira, who lay curled on a bed of moss, amusing herself by releasing plumes of smoke from her nostrils and watching them roil out of sight. Without preamble, she said,
"There is plenty of room for me on the ground now. I will have no difficulty."
"Good." He mounted Folkvir and followed Oric and the elves farther into the empty, silent forest. Saphira crawled beside him. She and the white horses gleamed in the sombre half-light. Aragorn paused, overcome by the solemn beauty of his surroundings. Everything had a feeling of wintry age, as if nothing had changed under the thatched needles for 1,000 years and nothing ever would. Time itself seemed to have fallen into a slumber from which it would never wake. In late afternoon, the gloom lifted to reveal an elf standing before them, sheathed in a bright ray of light that slanted down from the ceiling. He was garbed in flowing robes with a circlet of silver upon his brow. His face was old, noble, and serene. "Aragorn," murmured Arya, "show him your palm and your ring." Baring his right hand, Aragorn raised it, so that first Brom's ring and then the Gedwe Ignazia was visible. The elf smiled, closed his eyes, and spread his arms in a gesture of welcome. He held the posture. "The way is clear," said Arya. At a soft command, her steed moved forward. They rode around the elf like water parting at the base of a weathered boulder, and when they had all passed, he straightened, clasped his hands, and vanished, as the light that illuminated him ceased to exist.
"Who is he?"
asked Saphira. Arya said,
"He is Gilderion the Wise, Prince of House Mialandra, wielder of the White Flame of Vandal, and guardian of Ellesmira since the days of Dúfirn Skúlblaka, our war with the dragons. None may enter the city unless he permits it."
A quarter of a mile beyond, the forest thinned, and breaks appeared within the canopy, allowing planks of mottled sunlight to bar the way. Then they passed underneath two burled trees that leaned against each other and stopped at the edge of an empty glade. The ground was strewn with dense patches of flowers, from pink roses to bluebells and lilies. Spring's fleeting treasure was heaped about like piles of rubies, sapphires and opals. Their intoxicating aromas attracted hordes of bumblebees. To the right, a stream chuckled behind a row of bushes, while a pair of squirrels chased each other around a rock. At first it looked to Aragorn like a place where deer might bed for the night, but as he continued to stare, he began to pick out paths hidden among the brush and trees. Soft, warm light where normally there would be auburn shadows. An odd pattern in the shapes of the twigs and branches and flowers, so subtle that it nearly escaped detection. Clues that what he saw was not entirely natural. He blinked, and his vision suddenly shifted as if a lens had been placed over his eyes, resolving everything into recognizable shapes. Those were paths, aye, and those were flowers, aye. But what he had taken to be clusters of lumpy, twisted trees were in fact graceful buildings that grew directly out of the pines. One tree bulged at the base to form a two-story house before sinking its roots into the loam. Both stories were hexagonal, although the upper level was half as small as the first, which gave the house a tiered appearance. The roofs and walls were made of webbed sheets of wood draped over six thick ridges. Moss and yellow lichen bearded the eaves and hung over jewelled windows set into each side. The front door was a mysterious black silhouette recessed under an archway wrought with symbols. Another house was nestled between three pines, which were joined to it through a series of curved branches. Reinforced by those flying buttresses, the house rose five levels, light and airy. Beside it sat a bower woven out of willow and dogwood and hung with flameless lanterns disguised as galls. Each unique building enhanced and complemented its surroundings, blending seamlessly with the rest of the forest until it was impossible to tell where artifice ended and nature resumed. The two were in perfect balance. Instead of mastering their environment, the elves had chosen to accept the world as it was and adapt themselves to it. The inhabitants of Ellesmere eventually revealed themselves as a flicker of movement at the fringe of Aragorn's sight, no more than needles stirring in the breeze. Then he caught glimpses of hands, a pale face, a sandaled foot, an upraised arm. One by one, the wary elves stepped into view, their almond eyes fixed upon Saphira, Arya, and Aragorn. The women wore their hair unbound. It rippled down their backs in waves of silver and sable, braided with fresh blossoms, like a garden waterfall. They all possessed a delicate, ethereal beauty that belied their unbreakable strength. To Aragorn they seemed flawless. The men were just as striking, with high cheekbones, finely sculpted noses and heavy eyelids. Both sexes were garbed in rustic tunics of green and brown, fringed with dusky colours of orange, russet and gold. "The fair folk indeed," thought Aragorn. He touched his lips in greeting. As one, the elves bowed from the waist. Then they smiled and laughed with unrestrained happiness. From within their midst, a woman sang, "Gala o weirder Brunvitter, aber Berendel vanderfutter, Bertro Laufsblader ecker under, im Kona daut liker." Aragorn clapped his hands over his ears, fearing that the melody was a spell like the one he had heard at Sealthrim. But Arya shook her head and lifted his hands. "It is not magic." Then she spoke to her horse, saying, "Ganga." The stallion nickered and trotted away. "Release your steeds as well. We have no further need of them, and they deserve to rest in our stables." The song waxed stronger as Arya proceeded along a cobblestone path set with bits of green tourmaline, which looped among the hollyhocks and the houses and the trees before finally crossing a stream. The elves danced around their party as they walked, flitting here and there as the fancy struck them, laughing and occasionally leaping up onto a branch to run over their heads. They praised Saphira with names like Longclaws and Daughter of Air and Fire and Strong One. Aragorn smiled, delighted and enchanted. "I could live here," he thought, with a sense of peace. Tucked away in Duweldenvarden, as much outdoors as in, safe from the rest of the world. Yes, he liked Ellesmere very much indeed, more than any of the dwarf cities. He pointed to a dwelling situated within a pine tree and asked Arya, "How is that done?" "We sing to the forest in the old tongue and give it our strength to grow in the shape that we desire. All our buildings and tools are made in that manner." The path ended at a net of roots that formed steps like bare pools of earth. They climbed to a door embedded within a wall of saplings. Aragorn's heart quickened as the door swung open, seemingly of its own accord, and revealed a hall of trees. Hundreds of branches melded together to form the honeycombed ceiling. Below, 12 chairs were arrayed along each wall. In them reposed 24 elf lords and ladies. Wise and handsome were they, with smooth faces unmarked by age and keen eyes that gleamed with excitement. They leaned forward, gripping the arms of their chairs, and stared at Aragorn's group with open wonder and hope. Unlike the other elves, They had swords belted at their waists, hilts studded with beryls and garnets, and circlets that adorned their brows. And at the head of the assembly stood a white pavilion that sheltered a throne of knotted roots. Queen Islandzadi sat upon it,